You're listening to MLB.com Extras, brought to you by MLB.tv. It's baseball everywhere.
Hi, everybody. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Anthony Kastrovitz, and this is our latest look at the Cleveland Indians. We are here at the winter meetings with Jordan Bastian and JB, obviously coming off a big year for the Tribe, AL champs. Mm-hmm. You're here in the building. Terry Francona is not. Right. What's up with that?
Well, my hip's better than Terry Francona's right now. Not by much. But no, he had hip surgery, and he had that done after the season was over. So still recovering. And, I mean, hey, the guy worked an extra month. The Indians have all kinds of people here in the front office to do the heavy lifting decision-wise. They can FaceTime in Terry Francona if they need him to, in one of these meetings. But he's still recovering. And, I mean, honestly, a well-deserved break for Terry Francona right now, manager of the year.
I know some other managers that probably wish they had hip surgery to get out of being here, but that's another story. You know, obviously the Indians are not known to be a team particularly active at the winter meetings. It is still somewhat early in the free agent game. We know they tend to operate more in the lower tier of free agency. Just what is their outlook here this week here in D.C.?
You know, obviously, I mean, this is a team that is the reigning champs. They came very close to winning it. Also, fans want them to be aggressive, want them to go after, you know, the big bats, and they do have a need for some right-handed power, which they addressed last year with Mike Napoli, who is a free agent again and is, again, of interest to them. So they're hoping to do it on a short-term solution. I mean, this payroll naturally is going to go over $100 million, which I believe is going to be the highest in franchise history, and it's naturally going up through arbitration, lots of cases. But they have need for right-handed power. They're going to try to address that, whether it's through Napoli or somebody else, and they're going to probably look at trades. I mean, trades are always the more realistic avenue for the Indians, you know, whether it's during the winter or whether it's at the trade deadline when they got an Andrew Miller or they almost had a Jonathan Lucroy. I mean, they showed aggressiveness on the trade front. I think if they're going to really be able to add somebody impactful and be able to afford it, it's probably going to be have to be on the trade front rather than a blockbuster free agent signing.
Hey, I know a right-handed hitter who's mentioned in the trade market is Andrew McCutchen. It's a short drive from Pittsburgh to Cleveland,
right?
Too. What do you think of that?
Yeah, you know, on some fronts, it's a good fit. You know, many teams look at his salary as a benefit, $14 million. For the Indians right now, it's just a little too tight, and that's why you're seeing, you know, Carlos Beltran signs for 1 year, $16 million, and that's just, it's too much for the Indians right now. You know, it's, you know, fans don't want to hear that, but that's the reality of this situation. McCutchen, because of his salary, is probably not a fit, and also you got to consider the fact that his days as a center fielder might be over. You know, they have Michael Brantley potentially coming back for left field. They have a plethora of options for right field, whether it's platooning or otherwise. And they have Naquin and some other guys for center who could mix in. They want to get outfield depth. I just don't see McCutchen being that answer.
All right, so obviously Napoli is a player of interest. Had a big, you know, 34 home run season, career year for them,
right,
in 2016. We also know his market could be strong just as a function of coming off that career year. The Indians didn't make him the qualifying offer, so he's not tied to a draft pick. That certainly helps his market. We know he wants multiple years. Indians might be more, you know, in the one-year range. So what are some other options if Napoli is not a fit or if he signs elsewhere? What are some other options at first base?
Yeah, I think they're going to monitor the market for a guy like Chris Carter, who led the league in home runs. You've got Mitch Moreland out there. On a lesser level, you've got guys like Adam Lind, who can maybe platoon a little bit. I mean, they have some flexibility, whether it's addressing via the outfield, you know, where you could use the DH slot to rotate guys around, or, again, kind of like Napoli last year, first base DH. I think that's kind of what they're targeting, is that first base DH role to split with Carlos Santana. But those are some of the options. But I think in a perfect world, they'd be able to get Napoli back. But what they showed in the qualifying offer, which is $17 million, they weren't willing to pay that much.
Right.
You know, and last year I think they had him for $10 total. Mm-hmm. You know, that's kind of their price range right now. And they're hoping if he can't get that multi-year deal that he's seeking, because he is coming off a career year at an older age, you know, maybe he can come back into their price range and into their market on a short-term deal.
And their other prominent free agent, of course, is Rajay Davis. But the outfield doesn't seem to be the glaring necessity it was a year ago, where Brantley's situation was maybe a little more questionable than it is now. Not that it's not questionable now, but it seems a little more safe to assume he's part of the opening day picture than it was a year ago.
Yeah, I mean, they have to build in contingency plans. You can't count on Brantley again. He played 11 games. They're expecting him to be ready for spring training and opening day. But they were expecting him to be ready at a lot of different points last year, and it just didn't happen. So he's expected to be fine, you know, and they're counting on him to be their left fielder. But I think it would be in their best interest to kind of come up with some contingency plans. And Rajai Davis was kind of that perfect fit last year where he could play all three. He offers that speed element. If Brantley was back, he could slide into a platoon role and still be a fit. And I think that kind of player who's versatile in what he can bring to the table is going to be what they're targeting again. And again, they would like to have Rajai Davis back on a one-year deal. You know, he would fit perfectly. Otherwise, they're probably going to target similar versatile speed-type outfielders, whether it's free agency or via trade.
Let's talk about the bullpen. It was, of course, such a separator for the Tribe in October. And they non-tendered Jeff Manship last week. You know, financial gain there. Obviously, they'd like to have him back under different terms, but didn't want to go to arbitration with him. And then the big fish, of course, in this trade market would be Andrew Miller, but certainly doesn't seem like they're inclined to explore that value.
I think especially because they finished short of winning the World Series. Yeah. They know they're in a better position right now with Andrew Miller to get back there. They're in a great spot in the division right now. The Central looks like it's theirs. And a big reason that it looks like it's theirs is because of the strength of their bullpen behind a very strong rotation. The bullpen right now, I think, projects to make around $25 million, including the $9 million that the Indians took on in that trade for this year and then $9 million again next year. One of the reasons they like Andrew Miller in that trade and were willing to give up so many top prospects was the fact that he was under control for more than just last year. So they're able to keep that bullpen together, Cody Allen, Andrew Miller. You know, you shed a little bit of salary with Manship, and I think they like to, this winter, add another lefty to pair with Miller in the bullpen. But their bullpen's pretty much set, and I really don't see a situation that Miller gets traded this offseason. If the season were to fall apart and things don't go as planned and there's injuries and things go wrong, his value would be there again at the trade deadline if they wanted to recoup some of the prospects that they lost last year.
Well, speaking of injuries and things going wrong, I mean, a year ago at this time, we're talking about the rotation is such a strength of this team, and it's so deep. Maybe they'll even move one of those guys to add a hitter and that sort of thing. And they ended up finishing the year with 2.5 starters in the World Series. So you see how that can erode quickly. And they did claim Tim Cooney, who made some starts for the Cardinals a couple years back and then had shoulder problems last year. They hope to stretch him out, of course. And Mike Clevenger is a depth piece. But do you see them active at all on the starting front for even more depth?
You know, I think every team's going to, again, be calling on guys like Salazar and Carrasco. I think we saw last year down the stretch the depth was exposed, and they didn't have the type of depth we thought they had behind the front five guys. So I think it's going to be prudent to keep those guys again, especially at the value they have. I think the whole group combined is around $24 million. There's six pitchers in the big leagues who have higher salaries than that just by themselves. So I think it's going to be in their best interest to keep that group together. If they're going to target anything for the rotation, probably be some of those depth guys, like you mentioned, Cooney, you know, guys that are going to be at AAA, maybe some guys with big league experience to kind of make sure that if they run into injuries or issues like they did last year, you know, you have guys who can fill in short-term basis.
All right, there you have it. The latest from Jordan Bastian here at the Winter Meetings. I want to thank you all for joining us. Thanks for tuning in. This has been MLB.com Extras, Cleveland Indians edition.
Hi, everybody. I'm Anthony Kastrovitz, and this is our latest look at the Chicago White Sox. I'm joined by Scott Merkin here at the Winter Meetings. And Merk, we knew going in the White Sox could make some noise here. The rebuilding process could begin, and it began with a big blast here on Tuesday at the Winter Meetings with Chris Sale trade to the Boston Red Sox. White Sox get back Yoan Moncada, Michael Kopech, Luis Alexander Basabi, and Victor Diaz. Look, again, we knew this could come together. It was just a matter of would the right package present itself. The Red Sox were, I won't say a totally mystery team, but they were certainly a team that kind of swooped in late here. Can you tell us about how this deal came together?
I had heard a little bit about the Red Sox over the weekend, and I had talked to some Sox people, and they said legitimately at that point it really wasn't a big thing. And Dave Dombrowski said today at one of the press conferences that Friday was when Rick had kind of approached him and engaged him and said, you know, we're going to trade Chris Sale, wanted to see if you're interested. And, you know, Dave Dombrowski's credit, you don't pass on Chris Sale. I get the commodity, and you understand, too, the commodity that young prospects have in this day, probably more than any other time that I can remember in baseball, which probably topped last year when it had the same high commodity. But, you know, you got to give someone up to get something back. And in Chris Sale, you get, I would say, the best pitcher in the American League and maybe the best pitcher not named Clayton Kershaw in baseball. You know, I mean, Max Scherzer's in there too. But, I mean, he's ace stuff, ace competitor, good kid in the clubhouse, good kid in the community. He'll fit in great in Boston. And in return, the Sox began, as you said, make some noise. It was kind of a sonic boom with their, you know, rebuilding process. They get Moncada, who's going to be a you know, what they feel is a high-end defensive and offensive player up the middle. I think they picture him at second base. He can play second or third. Rick didn't want to go into comparisons, but he, you know, there are some mentions of comparing him to Robinson Cano of his style of play. Michael Kopech is a 100-mile-an-hour guy. I think his hit is as high as 105. You know, you put him at the beginning of the rotation and have Zach Birdie, who they drafted last year, at the back, and you got some hard fastballs coming at you there. And then, you know, Bisabi and Diaz are guys who are more projects. They're Class A guys, so you'll see how they come along. But, you know, I refer back to 2013 when they had the Jake Peavy deal and got Avisaíl Garcia. Frankie Montes was kind of a same guy, you know, a Class A guy that came with it, had a good rep, you know, a hard thrower, ended up making the Sox, and ended up using him to get Todd Frazier in the trade last year. So, you know, every little piece counts, and it's only just begun, as they say in the song.
Now,
the Carpenters said that.
I think the Carpenters did say that. As recently as Monday night, it seemed like the Nationals might be the destination for Chris Sale. Do we know much about what that package looked like, and or maybe just how things shifted back to Boston?
I think, you know, the names we heard, Giolito and Robles, were the main guys. They were not going to include Trey Turner. It's hard for me to blame them on that, because what he did in just a short time last year was kind of Mike Trout-like, you know, so I don't think you, even for Chris Sale, I'm not sure if you give him up in part of a package. So I think it was something along those lines, and I think once that news came out, maybe, you know, Boston kind of stepped up and increased the offer a little bit more and, you know, made it a little harder for Rick to turn down. And it turns out, you know, they went with the Red Sox package.
All right, so what does this mean? Are the floodgates open now? We've talked on previous podcasts about some of the possibilities. There, Todd Frazier, David Robertson, Jose Abreu. It seems like when you trade your best player, and especially when he's under reasonable contractual control for the next 3 years, it seems like you have no untouchables.
Right. We're joking about in the press conference, and I'm not sure if Rick did this inadvertently, but someone asked him, what's the message you give to Sox fans now? How do you sell this to Sox fans? And he said, remember, we still have some good players, you know, who will be in Chicago next year. And he said Carlos Rodon, Tim Anderson, and then he paused and said, and others. So I have a feeling Tim Anderson and Carlos Rodon, they can maybe buy. Everyone else should probably rent, because everyone else might be on the table to be traded. You know, there's, as you said, Quintana, you know, a team like the Nationals and the Astros, who both had interest in Sale. I think the Nationals a little more than the Astros, may turn around and say, well, Quintana's an all-star. Quintana's got this great, flawless delivery. Quintana's thrown 200 innings each of the last 4 years. Why not go after him? You know, and I think the Sox aren't looking to trade him, so they weren't looking to trade Sale. But if the deal is, you know, somewhat close to what it was for Sale, how can you turn down trading two guys and getting, you know, seven or eight viable prospects? And Frazier makes sense, you know, 1 year left on his deal before he goes into free agency. Great clubhouse guy, few true pure power hitters, I think, in the game. You know, Adam Eaton, great defensive player, kind of an offensive spark plug, has that kind of gritty grinder attitude. Nate Jones, a controllable late-inning guy. David Robertson, 2 years, $25 million left. Both closer opportunities when really the closer market is, what, Jansen, Chapman, both very high money projected. And then, you know, Wade Davis if there's a trade, and Greg Holland who's coming back from injury. So two pretty good alternatives. So basically, to make a long answer short, which is too late now, there's a lot of options for them to really build on this rebuild that's begun today.
You see, in the Sale trade, there's a balance here, right? I mean, they got a position player prospect in Moncada. And I'm talking about Moncada and Kopech obviously front this deal. Moncada, of course, on the cusp position player prospect, and then Kopech, a high upside pitching prospect. They didn't go all in on one or the other, one element or the other. So it seems like you never know what you're going to get with prospects. They are, you know, like people say, they are suspects as well, but it seems like there is a good balance in their haul here.
The thing with prospects is, you know, you can have – I remember when they traded Fernando Tatis Jr. for James Shields. Everyone said, oh, that's a, you know, a big win for San Diego because they got Tatis. Well, he was, I think, 17 at the time. He may turn out to be the next Derek Jeter. He may never see the major leagues. You have no idea at that point when you're trading a guy that young. Now, you know, he had a high-end reputation, a great talent just like Moncada did. So you're not sure, Ian, but you're right. There is a balance. I think they do have to get a little more pitching back, especially if they trade Quintana. They got to have guys to kind of fill the innings there. You know, they are playing 162 games next year, even if they are in a rebuild. They can't just go to 2018 and say, we're good for 17. So they got to look at that. But, yeah, I think they really seem to have a good focus and a good plan. And the biggest thing is, for a couple years where it just seemed like, I don't want to say nothing but misery, but just kind of organized chaos a little bit. And nothing, not pointing to anyone in general, just how it played out. You know, to go from 23-10 and a six-game lead last year, then lose 26 of your next 36 games. It seemed like there was a lot of, well, we're bad, but we're not that bad. If we go on a 6-0 run, we can get that second wild card and sneak in. So there wasn't exactly that level of enthusiasm. And I think now there's really a focused excitement throughout the whole organization in the direction they're going.
Merck, you covered Chris Sale from the very beginning of his career,
of course.
You got to know him well. I remember when the whole throwback jersey fiasco went down, you had lunch with him. I think he had the fish tacos, if I remember.
He had the fish tacos, and I had a chicken sandwich, I think.
Okay. Well, just for the listeners, just kind of reflect on your experience covering him and watching him ascend to this Cy Young caliber all-star status.
You've got to be objective, obviously. That's your job as a reporter. But I think all of us can look back. You know, I've done this for 15 years now and say, okay, here are some of the best guys to cover, and Chris would be on that list, right at the top of that list. He's a great kid. He had great humor. He was ultra competitive. And, yes, I know there were some situations that Rick Hahn even said today were a little bit uneasy at times, but I think maybe the method wasn't always perfect, that he could have changed a little bit, but the message is always right in that he wanted to win. He wanted to be competitive. You know, I talked to him a couple times. It's like every spring training after he signed that extension, someone, you know, Kershaw signed an extension or Scherzer signed for $200 million. And you went in and talked to him and said, is this bothering you? He's like, nope, this is what I signed up for. I want to be here. I want to win with this team. This is the team that gave me the chance. I knew what I was doing when I signed this contract. I'm not going to complain now. And that's 98% of the time of what Chris Sale was about. Chris was a good kid, focused on that team. He was great in the clubhouse. You know, the story I'll give you is Carson Fulmer, one of their top pitching prospects, probably just below Kopech now coming in, but was their top pitching prospect, first-round pick. And Chris Sale kind of took him under his wing last spring, last offseason, had him over to the house for dinner, played golf with him, and just kind of, you know, showed him the way. And it's what Mark Burley did for Chris and Jake Peavy did for Chris before Chris became the guy. Chris had the longest tenure of anyone on the Sox. Now it's Quintana and Nate Jones from 2012. So I think Chris is going to do great in Boston. I know more than anything else, he wanted to pitch in the playoffs. He would trade any Cy Young contention, any 15-17 win season for a playoff start, and I think he's going to get that with Boston.
You know, he entered with durability questions and questions about his delivery.
And even was out of the rotation. I mean, he started as reliever for the first year and a half, was even out of the rotation briefly in his first year, and now 5 years later he's a five-time All-Star and arguably, you know, one of the most electric pitchers in the game and one of the best. I remember his first appearance was in Baltimore, and we joke about this still, where he walked a guy and gave a bloop single, and Ozzie Guillen took him out. And after the game we talked to him, and Chris just, like, stared straight at his locker. One or two word answers, and he ended up becoming one of the best quotes, at least in the Sox. I can't speak for everyone in the league, but he was a great quote. He really understood the game.
All right, that's the latest from Scott Merkin. I want to thank him for joining us, and I have a hunch we'll hear from you again here this offseason.
Yeah.
Thank you all for tuning in. This has been MLB.com Extra, Chicago White Sox edition.
Hi, everybody. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Anthony Kastrovitz, and this is our latest look at the Detroit Tigers. I'm joined by Jack Zarensic and Jason Beck. And Beck, boy, the Tigers could be an active team here at these winter meetings. Not in the realm that we're expected to see them being active. Usually it's the additions. This year it might be the subtractions. What is their outlook as far as, you know, we know they have a lot of veteran players who could be of interest to other clubs. How aggressive is the mentality to maybe move some pieces here?
Well, I mean, it depends on, I think, the time frame, and it depends on what you hear. You know, they've got to be able to move some salary. I think they need some financial flexibility. That's the end goal of this, in addition to getting this team a little bit younger for the long haul. You know, they want to be able to get under a luxury tax threshold. That's got to happen. I don't think they want to be in a position to be a repeat offender in terms of paying that accelerated rate on the luxury tax. So from that standpoint, they've got to move some pieces. That's the only way they can do it. They say they don't want to do bad deals. They want to be able to get some parts back that can help them long term. So I think what we're going to see over the course of these winter meetings is this a serious approach, or is this posturing to try to get a little bit more back from teams that are so far willing to call their bluff?
And some of the names you've been hearing are big names. You know, when you hear that Miguel Cabrera has basically lifted his no trade, J.D. Martinez is a possible name that's floated out there. You're talking about guys that have been real producers for a ball club that is – kind of in a winnable division if things fall their way.
Oh, yeah. And it's fine to look at what the Tigers are doing from the standpoint of the rest of the division, because you see the Royals, you know, possibly paring back. You see the White Sox in a spot where they could have a number of players on the trading block. So if you look at what the rest of the division is doing, Twins rebuilding too, it's not a division that's out of reach for them. If a few things go their way, they could compete with the Indians with the team they have. But I think what we're looking at is, do they feel like they have a realistic chance of competing? And if they can't catch the Indians, can they compete for a wild card? And is that chase worth being in that $200 million payroll threshold again to be willing to do that? Right now, the indications are they don't want to do that, that the penalty is not worth the reward.
You mentioned that the Tigers want to get under luxury tax threshold, as a lot of teams do. And we just, you know, we have a new collective bargaining agreement now. We know what those thresholds are going to be moving forward. And pretty modest raises to the threshold as you forecast the next 5 years. And I just wonder if that undercuts the Tigers' efforts in any way when you are talking about a Miguel Cabrera, Justin Verlander. These are monster contracts. And, you know, the number of teams who can reasonably take that on without getting into the luxury tax realm is few and far between. So I just wonder how that affects their trade market.
Well, I mean, the good news from the luxury tax standpoint is that they have, you know, lesser distance to go to get under it.
Right.
Certainly for this coming season, and it's even more forgiving long term. But yeah, the penalties that come up for teams that are repeatedly over it, and the penalties for teams that are grossly over it, kind of makes it a little bit more difficult to move guys. Plus, there's the fact that from a draft pick compensation standpoint, you're looking at less of a compensation pick for teams that are over the luxury tax. So, you know, if they keep everybody, and this is what we, you know, the argument has been, well, why don't you keep everybody and then payroll naturally goes down as you lose guys in free agency? Yes, but now under the terms of the new CBA, instead of looking at a first or a second round pick, you're looking at a pick, you know, if you're over the luxury tax, at the end of the fourth, being in the fifth round, which makes a huge difference in the type of prospects you can get in return and in, you know, potentially how quickly such a prospect can help you down the road.
You know, what's interesting about that is, as I look at this, I think of a club that says, we're going to go for it, but at the trading deadline, you've got to make a decision on trading your players that are potential free agents, simply because the return is no longer a first-round pick. So you could be saying to yourself, someone's in double-A or someone's in triple-A, someone's in A-ball. I got a little better indication of what I'm going to be getting in a third round waiting for a draft pick to come your way.
Right, and this is a group that's, you know, they've been able to get some value out of these picks, but there's a little bit more certainty when you're looking at other teams' prospects. You've had a better opportunity to scout another team's farm system. The Tigers do a very good job of looking at other organizations. One of the things that they did when they transitioned from Dave Dombrowski to Al Avila's GM was they beefed up their scouting, not just at the major league end, but also being able to have these guys scout entire organizations, get an idea of what they're looking at in the farm system. So instead of scouting leading up to a trade deadline, these scouts can look at an organization throughout the course of a season and get a really good snapshot of what they have. And it's a little bit more reliable than, say, scouting for the draft, looking at, you know, what is available in the Southeastern Conference, in some of the mid-major teams, in high schools over the course of a spring.
Yeah, Joe Smith in Texarkana, Arkansas, you know, who's 17 years of age, as compared to a guy that's sitting in double A that has a track record.
Exactly.
Back when the Tigers moved some pieces midseason in 2015, they really targeted young starting pitching, ended up getting back the rookie of the year in Michael Fulmer and Daniel Norris, of course. I'm just wondering, do you have a sense of, beyond the obvious, which is salary relief, you know, what would they be targeting in deals involving these guys?
They'd like more pitching because, you know, now that group of prospects that they got, those guys are in the major leagues right now, and they're a core part of the rotation. You know, you've got Fulmer, Norris, and Matt Boyd. You know, they were in the rotation for most of the second half. They're guys you're counting on going into next season, even when you've got Anibal Sanchez, Mike Pelfrey under contract. You need your young guys right now. That's the core of the rotation, especially depending on what happens with Verlander. If you get a sweetheart deal for him and he moves, then those young guys are most likely your top three starters unless you get somebody big in return. So, but they don't have the depth behind them to fortify that. You know, the guys who were insurance starters going into last season, those are your core guys. Now you need a new group for insurance starters, and they don't have that depth at double A, even at high class A ball, to kind of fill in right now. They'd like to have that group that's close to major league ready to kind of fill that gap.
You know, looking at the Detroit Tigers over recent years, they've been so aggressive either in payroll or acquiring players because they've wanted to win, it appears, for Mr. Ilitch. And now it looks like a little bit of a different scenario here.
That's the question that's most frequently come up, is that, is this a sign that ownership is changing or that, you know, there's a big transition up top and trickling on down? I don't think you embark on something like this without at least some direction from ownership. Does this mean that Mike Ilitch is giving up the fight? I think that's a big topic of speculation. There's no firm signs on that yet, but I think there's at least some signs that this organization's looking at the long term. And I think you can see the increasing influence of a guy like Chris Ilitch, Mike Ilitch's son, who's done a lot more day-to-day stuff, not just with the Tigers, but also with a lot of aspects of the Ilitch ownership. You see his imprint on what's going on with the Red Wings, with the new arena that's going up between Midtown and downtown, with the partnership that they've got going on with the Pistons moving downtown. You know, this is no longer just a Mike Ilitch operation. I think this is an Ilitch family operation more and more. You see that all over what they're doing business-wise.
All right, that's the latest from Jason Beck. I want to thank him for joining us. Thank you all for tuning in. This has been MLB.com Extras, Detroit Tigers edition.
Hi, everybody. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Anthony Kastrovitz, and this is our latest look at the Kansas City Royals. I'm joined here at the winter meetings by Jeffrey Flanagan. And Jeffrey, this is going to be interesting. Whether it's this week or this month or this offseason, the Royals have some very interesting decisions ahead just from a financial standpoint as they try to maintain a competitive front here. Going into 2017, they're also trying to cut costs.
You got to blow it up. Trade everyone.
I mean, it's one way to go about it.
Yeah, you're right, though. I mean, they're at a crossroads here. They got 7 or 8 free agents after 2017, but you got to balance that with trying to be competitive and getting back to the World Series next year. So do you make a couple of, you know, deals here or not? It has to improve the team now and toward the future, so that's the tricky part. But, yeah, financially, they're strapped, too. The payroll is going to be 145, which is going to be another record. They can't go any more above that, so they won't be players in the free agent market. But they could. You'll hear Wade Davis's name pop up, or Gerard Dyson, or maybe Lorenzo Cain. You're going to hear a lot of rumors like that.
Yeah, and one thing I wonder about the Royals, this new collective bargaining agreement. Now we know that the terms moving forward the next 5 years, and draft pick compensation has changed so drastically. You wonder if that does change the Royals' mindset when you talk about having so many pending free agents. Now the equation's a lot different. Before, maybe you could bank on a first-round pick should you extend the qualifying offer and they sign elsewhere. The qualifying offer itself is a complicated conversation because it's so expensive,
exactly.
Might be $18 million or so. But now that the draft pick compensation might not be as strong as it once was, maybe there's more incentive to move those guys.
Yeah, I mean, you bring up the QO. I mean, it's going to be up to $18 million next year. Well, what small market team can pay a guy $18 million other than maybe – you know, Eric Hosmer is probably worth that much, but are you going to pay Moose that or Escobar or, you know, even Wade Davis? He's an elite closer, but $18 million. One of the reasons why they didn't offer Morales or Volquez the QO this year is they were afraid they were going to take it. And now you're stuck paying $17 million to a guy, who's probably not worth that on the open market. So compensation or not, I think the biggest hurdle for a team like the Royals is just offering the QO. They just can't do that to their payroll right now.
So of all the pending free agents, I think Wade Davis probably has the most tangible trade value in this market just because of how we've seen the relief market explode in general. Maybe you can make the case for Hosmer, but there's a lot of first base,
right,
you know, DH-type bats. So I would probably lean towards Davis there. What are your expectations there, basically? I mean, we know how important the bullpen has been to this club, and yet we know, boy, here's a real opportunity to get some young talent back.
And they'd have to get some young talent and somebody that could help right now,
right?
Because, I mean, the number one concern this offseason was to try to get that bullpen back to a shutdown status, which it was not last year. So how do you do that? By trading away its best piece. You know, that's the tricky part for Dayton Moore right now, is he's probably got to have to move someone like that, but he needs to get something big in return because when they faded down the stretch, it was because the bullpen betrayed them, so to speak. So, you know, you got Moose, you got you mentioned Hosmer, Escobar, Dyson, the list goes on and on. Danny Duffy's another guy who could draw a lot of interest too, but do you really want to trade your best young left-handed pitcher? So all these decisions Dayton Moore and his staff are talking about right now.
And Duffy, obviously there's maybe some attempt to re-sign him,
absolutely,
extend him. Where does that stand right now?
They're still having talks. They're kicking the tires on that. Both sides have agreed that they want to do this, so I think it gets done before spring training.
Okay. Well, there's maybe one less name on the
right,
trade
there
candidate
you go.
List. That would be nice. Dyson's interesting to me, just as a guy who has obviously had great value to the Royals. But if it is a possibility to shed a couple million dollars, and he has such value, you know, in a game that has more of a defensive mindset, that kind of thing. There's a lot of teams, you know, looking for center field help in particular. So
he's the most cost efficient guy they
sure.
got though.
Yeah.
So I mean,
yeah.
it'd be tough to part ways with someone who's only making 2.5. You know, that doesn't really move the chains
but
very much.
But the value of him relative to his salary makes him more valuable in the trade market.
Exactly.
Kane
yeah.
coming off an injury plagued year. It's always delicate conversations of what a guy is worth. Sometimes they're worth more than you think. Sometimes less than
yeah.
you think in the trade market.
Well, he proved the last 6 weeks last year that he could hit lead off. We know how good defensively he can steal 30 bases, 40 bases if he plays regularly. So I do think he has some value.
As far as needs go, what are the Royals' shopping list right now? And I know you got to have the funds
money
to fill
to,
that shopping list. But in a dream world, what would they be adding?
Well, I think bullpen. They have to start there. Depending on what you do with Wade Davis, they do need some back end pieces there. They need a guy like Soria to come back and have a better year than he did last year. You may be looking for a fifth starter. Dayton always wants to go into spring training with 8 or 9 viable candidates in the rotation. Right now, he's got maybe 5 or 6. So, I mean, I think you'll see some bottom feeding through the free agent market, so to speak. And, finding that guy that they found, like a Dylan G or something like that they found last year for something inexpensive. And they still haven't given up the idea of maybe finding a full-time DH. But, again, costs are prohibitive, so they'll probably end up having a floating DH. But they said this 2 years ago, and then they went out and signed Kendrys Morales.
Right, so. Right. And he of course is very quickly signed elsewhere. So we'll see how that market shapes up for them. But they do have a spot open for the Rule 5. You can talk about bottom feeding. Maybe there's an opportunity to
absolutely.
Add a body.
They just went down to 39, so they can participate in Thursday's Rule 5 draft. I don't know if they'll do anything, but at least they'll be there.
Here on the first day of the meetings, Ned Yost has already had his manager session. Just what is his outlook? What is his attitude about basically what's going on here? This is a little bit of a transition period right now.
It is. I think he's anxious to get back to spring training and see that energy that they had maybe in 14 and 15 that wasn't present last year. He talked a lot about the fatigue that this team showed last year, and we saw it with injuries. We saw it with that overall attitude and stuff. And I think they'll come back. I think they'll have pretty much the same team going into spring training. But I think it'll come back with a whole different attitude that we didn't see last year. I think they're hungry to at least get one more title.
All right, there you have it. The latest word from Jeffrey Flanagan. I want to thank him for joining us. Thank you all for tuning in. This has been MLB.com Extras, Kansas City Royals edition. Hi, everybody. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Anthony Kastrovitz, and this is our latest look at the Minnesota Twins. I'm joined by Rhett Bollinger here at the winter meetings. And, Rhett, Twins, obviously, a team in transition right now with a new front office regime, but I'm sure they have a lot of work cut out for them just getting settled in Minnesota, and yet they've been fairly active here the last few weeks. Jason Castro signing, obviously some personnel moves. Just talk about the new regime and the immediate impact on the organization.
They've definitely been active, as you said. Signing Jason Castro to a 3-year deal solves a big need. They needed a catcher, especially one who's going to work with that young pitching staff. Guy who's a great defensive catcher, known for his work behind the plate. Some personnel changes also in the front office. Made some promotions in terms of their scouting staff. Darren Johnson was promoted to senior scout. Sean Johnson is now the director of scouting for them. It's one of those things where it's kind of a collaboration. Falvey's the main guy in charge here. Levine's going to also have a voice as well, kind of a collaboration effort. I think Falvey might have a little bit of the final word on the signings, but I think for the most part, this new front office, the whole thing about it is going to be collaboration. Obviously hiring some guys from outside, guys like Torrey Hunter, Michael Kadire, LaTroy Hawkins. So the front office has definitely changed a little bit, but a lot of it's going to be kind of a collaborative effort, I think, is kind of the way we're going to look at it here.
The Castro signing was interesting. Of course, he was one of the prominent names. I know he had a miserable offensive season, so maybe some fans are surprised by that. But he was a prominent name in this market, just the dearth of catching in general, and also, you know, his value, pitch framing, which is very highly valued in today's game. So, you know, good aggressive signing for the Twins there.
Yeah, absolutely. A little bit of a surprise, as you said. You know, Twins are kind of in transition. They gave him a three-year deal. More than anything, I think it's just going to help their pitching because, like I said, the pitch framing is a big part of it. He's a great pitch framer. I think he was the fourth best in baseball at that last year. And as you know, it's kind of become more and more of a metric we're seeing kind of gain some importance because we know that, you know, if you can kind of get more strikes for your pitchers, it's going to help. And we know last year that Kurt Suzuki was not a great pitch framer. Good defender, you know, obviously had a better year offensively than even Castro did, but not a great pitch, you know, framer the way that Castro is. Castro is a former All-Star. He has some power. He certainly doesn't, you know, he's not a great offensive player, but there is some value there. That's obviously why he got a three-year deal.
How about the outlook here at the winter meetings? Again, there's transition going on here. The Twins are certainly rumored to be moving some pieces. We'll see if that actually happens. But we know they're not going to be one of the major spenders here at the winter meetings. But what do you think is their mentality going into this?
I think the big thing at the winter meetings, the Twins are definitely looking for starting pitching. We know they had the worst CRA in baseball last year among starting pitchers. So they need starting pitching, whether it's going to be signing a free agent or getting creative and making a trade, we'll see. As we know, Brian Dozier is the top trade chip for this team, coming off a season in which he hit 42 home runs, a lot of value there as a second baseman. But whether or not the Twins want to trade him, we'll see. They have to get a good, you know, package in return. They're going to be looking for starting pitching in part of that package. Maybe the Dodgers are a fit. Maybe they talk to the Dodgers. Maybe they package something around De Leon, you know, top pitching prospect for the Dodgers. That's kind of the big question mark, though. I mean, Dozier's a big part of this team. Not only is he obviously a great offensive player, but he's also the leader in that clubhouse. So to lose him would be tough even just for the fans, you know, in terms of selling the team for next year. So it's a tough decision for this front office, but they're certainly going to listen to every offer they get on Dozier.
And Dozier's actually here at the winter meetings, which if you want to facilitate a trade, I guess that's one way to go about it. He's here for other reasons, of course, you know, more on the marketing side. But that does add a little wrinkle to this conversation, doesn't it?
It really does. It is pretty funny. He's here for the Under Armour marketing effort here. I think MLB is going to change to Under Armour in 2020 for their uniforms. And he's here as part of that. But, yeah, it's pretty funny to be having your name swirl around in all these trade rumors the last few weeks and to actually be here at the winter meetings in the heart of it. And we're going to talk to him here in person in a, you know, a couple hours here.
He means so much to the Twins, obviously, especially coming off the year he's coming off. But you can understand where if this is an opportunity to sell high or to take advantage of his value in this trade market, that's understandable. Another guy who kind of fits along with that is Irvin Santana, just because the free agent market, as we know, for starting pitching is so weak. And there are some big names, you know, Chris Sales of the world, who are going to take an overwhelming, you know, prospect haul to acquire. Then you got a guy like Irvin Santana who's under contract for a couple of years, coming off a solid year. At the same time, means so much to the Twins who need pitching. So where do you see that conversation?
Yeah, it's a tough one. As you said, he means so much to this team. Last year, he was the only starting pitcher for the Twins that was, you know, consistent and above average. I mean, he had a great year last year. He's a veteran. He's kind of a leader on that pitching staff, especially the younger starters. So to trade him would definitely be tough because at this point, it's hard to say who else they can count on. You know, you're hoping that guys are going to come back and be healthy, guys like Phil Hughes. You're going to hope Kyle Gibson's going to bounce back. You've got some young prospects in that, you know, in that list. Mejia is one of those guys, but at the same time, Santana is the one guy you know in that rotation, is kind of the anchor of that rotation and your ace. So to trade him, they'd have to get, you know, some young starting pitching in return, and that would certainly be a signal that they're definitely rebuilding. The Twins haven't really said for sure that they're rebuilding. It's obvious that they're coming off a 103 loss season, and it's hard to go from 103 losses to a competitive team, but at the same time, it's not a full teardown yet either. We don't, you know, the Twins 2 years ago, as we know, were competitive. Anything can happen, so we'll see. But at the same time, I think that with Santana, they'll listen. But it's probably not going to be likely they're going to trade him just because he means so much to them as part of that rotation.
Where are they at payroll-wise? I mean, they're basically staying constant there. It doesn't seem like one of those situations where they're trying to cut payroll any way they can, basically.
No, it should be about the same. The only difference is, obviously, they decided outright Trevor Plouffe and Tommy Malone, and they're both arbitration eligible. So obviously, they'll be off the books. So that saves them roughly $11, $12 million. But they'll also have to pay guys for arbitration as well, and obviously the Castro deal. I at this point, I think they're probably going to be right around $100 million, so probably a little bit less than it was last year, but right in that ballpark.
So do you expect probably – it seems like a potential to be a quiet week for the Twins, but maybe that overwhelming offer does arrive in this market. It's got a lot of trade conversation taken on this week, obviously.
Exactly. It definitely could happen. I think for the most part, in terms of a signing, you're right. There's not going to be a major signing by the Twins. They're not going to make a big splash. Even Derek Falvey, I talked to him before – the winter meetings. He told me they're not there to win the winter meetings. They're not here to make a big splash and to sign a big free agent. Could it be a big trade? Sure. Obviously, if they get a great offer for Dozier or Santana, or even a guy like Kenny's Vargas, they could obviously make a trade for pitching. But in terms of signing a free agent, probably unlikely, especially here. I think more than anything here, too, I think internally with this new front office, I think it's a chance for Derek Falvey to kind of get to know a lot of the guys, the assistant GMs and even the scouting guys, and kind of get them all in person here and kind of get to know more about the organization and these people in general. So a lot of it's going to be laying groundwork. So in a sense, I don't see like a big move coming for the Twins this winter meetings.
For you personally, this is an important week for that regard as well. There's a relationship there between the media and the executives in the front office, and this is part of that relationship building as well.
Absolutely, yeah. It's gotten a chance to get to know Thad and Derek, both great guys. So far, I've been handling media really well, but a big part of their job. Terry Ryan, their predecessor, was really great with the media. It's a big part of their job to be able to deal with us every day. And so every day after end of the day, the winter meetings, they'll talk with us and kind of give us a recap of what they've been doing. They've both been great to deal with, and their relationship with the media is definitely an important part of their job.
All right. Well, Rhett's going to be all over it for MLB.com this week here at the winter meetings. I want to thank him for joining us, and thank you all for tuning in. This has been MLB.com Extras, Minnesota Twins edition.
MLB.tv Premium, the number one live streaming sports service, is celebrating 13 years. Watch every out-of-market regular season game live or on demand in true HD. Real-time highlights, live look-ins, pitch tracking widget, and more. MLB.tv Premium includes a free At-Bat 15 subscription. Watch live baseball on over 400 mobile and connected devices. Watch at home, in the office, or on the go, every night, on every device. Blackout and other restrictions apply. Visit MLB.tv for details.